activate a potential nugget.
The other thing I'm curious about, Vishi, is just there's this notion of what got you here wouldn't get you there as people scale up, let's say in the corporate world, and you need to pick up new skills for you to scale the next mountain. If you reflect on your journey, let's say for a minute, if I pick GM as a point, you were GM by the time you were 17, I think. Just to take that as an example, or maybe when you became world champion, talk to us a little bit about how your approach to growth has changed. Maybe if you just reflect on that phase and maybe the other critical inflection points.
Well, we have found that chess players tend to be good in certain things. Mm-hmm. The obvious connection you would make is, are they good in mathematical things? Because chess looks like a very logical mathematical game. Are they good in scientific stuff? I would say yes. Chess players are probably slightly overrepresented in those fields. Mm-hmm. But I know many chess players are excellent in languages as well. Mm-hmm. What I think chess players are very good at is at looking at a lot of information, mm-hmm. and working with those patterns. So wherever these patterns tend to be useful, so in things like financial trading, a lot of chess players moved into those fields. Mm-hmm. Because it looks very similar to this flood of new games from which you try to draw conclusions, and this flood of data about anything, and you work with that.
Sure.
It trains you to focus on one subject and stay in that subject till you've gotten an answer. Mm-hmm. And these are things that happen unconsciously over the chessboard, and then you carry over these skills elsewhere.
Sure.
I was quite surprised when I was in my early 20s, because it was clear to me that I was going to make a living as a chess player. Mm-hmm. I found quite a lot of my junior colleagues and all dropping out. Mm-hmm. They would become a grandmaster, and then a couple of years later, they wouldn't be so active for a while, and then a couple of years later, it would turn out they'd become bankers, or far fewer lawyers, bankers. You can see this, they could go for a traditional career, but not that traditional. Mm-hmm. Something like trading suits this chess mentality. Mm. And they always said that one of the biggest strengths for people, or some chess players got into poker as well, all of them usually said one of the things that chess taught them was objectivity. Mm-hmm. So this idea that a position is only what it is. Mm-hmm. If you played well until that point, your position is good. If you played badly until that point, your position is not good. Mm-hmm. And so they said they were surprised how many people in poker, for instance, or trading just felt lucky and did this or that. Mm-hmm. And for chess players, it was, you know, if my past moves were good, then I'll have a good position. It was very
devoid of emotion, right? It's just sort of,
yes, and also this idea that almost like good and bad. You know, if you had played well, then you would have a good position. There was almost a kind of justice supplying there, and they said that made them very strong because they tended not to get emotional or. In another way, even though they were in fields where you could gamble, they tended not to gamble. Or only gamble when they really felt the odds were favoring them, that sort of thing. Or gamble when the position was desperate. I mean, it influenced their thoughts in a certain way.
Okay.
But also there are many chess players who got into research. Because again, the university side of things, where you get used to this. Chess players generally are comfortable with other chess players. Mm-hmm. I think it's wrong to say they don't have social skills, but they have a certain kind of social skills. There are certain situations they're comfortable in. What you associate with nerdiness, I mean, it's an overused word probably, but... and so chess players gravitate naturally to those environments. Mm-hmm. A very controlled setting, because chess is a game played with quite rigid rules. Mm. So you tend to gravitate towards settings like that, and they feel uncomfortable. In areas like entrepreneurship and so on, because that calls for a totally different kind of skill set. Mm. So I find that far more chess players are these kinds of things than that. Though perhaps the chess players who know a bit about coding might straddle these worlds.
Got it. But back to your journey, Vishi, again, if we go back to becoming GM, did your approach to preparation or your approach to your game change significantly? What changed at that point in time?
I would say that as I climbed higher in the chess world, I realized that there were some skills that I was simply lacking, and I had to come. So I started to work seriously with a trainer before my first candidates match. So this is the candidates cycle for the world championship. And that's when I first started to work with a trainer. And that's interesting because for the first time, you don't just have an idea and you go to the board. You're actually... You're trying to impose some discipline on the process by which you come up with new ideas and things. Because in chess, everything that's new gets old very fast. So it's the stream of ideas. Now, 50 years ago, it was very slow. And then it kept speeding up. And now with computers and the internet, it's sped up insanely. But nonetheless, the first time you work with a trainer, you learn that there are totally different opinions and perspectives to yours. You realize that there are strong people who argue strongly for the moves you didn't see, and you try to learn from that. And then when I won my first match and I qualified to play Karpov, I worked with a Russian player. Again, the idea was I could benefit from the Russian training methods because they were the most sophisticated and advanced in this area. And I would say more recently, I've had to learn some of, reorient my style towards spontaneity and creativity again, essentially almost back to where I came from, because we've sort of come full circle. Now, maybe I over-prepare and then you need to rebalance that. So... I think the big change was clearly in my 20s when I first started working with trainers. And then suddenly chess is a very structured thing. And that was a big change for me.
And one thing I'm curious about is how people pick trainers, or if I use the term coaches in the corporate world. Having worked with different players, is there a what have you learned in terms of picking a good trainer or a coach from the wisdom of your journey?
I would say... And this is quite easy because when you pick someone to be close to, especially as a chess player, I mean, in a corporate environment, there are some buffers between you and the next person. So if you don't like someone, you still get to go home and he goes home and you don't have to see him for a day. And there are also the other people at the office. There are buffers. But in chess, it's much more raw because if you don't get along with your trainer, then you're really stuck with each other. It's... almost marriage style for that duration. So first thing is you must get along well with these people. Then I think it's very useful to have trainers who disagree with you because they will challenge your viewpoints and or trainers who are good in areas that you're weak in. I mean, you may be a better player than them overall, but that may mean that you're good in seven areas and they're good in three areas and those three areas are your weak suits. So you still can learn from someone who's who's weaker than you in competitive chess, but not in necessarily in training or understanding of chess. So that's the mix I tried to adhere to. Later on, I found that even though there are some people I really like, I genuinely like them as friends and so on, that they were reinforcing unhealthy qualities in me. So like if I'm cautious in certain situations and I'm trying to break out of that, the last thing I need is a trainer who's cautious there as well. Because you'll tend to reinforce your bad habits. So you should also see what it is you're trying to learn, what exactly you're trying to achieve with that training camp. And I would say subsequently, there are people who are friends of mine, so but who also... They have certain quirks that make you uncomfortable all day. But I have found that that can be healthy too. People who leave you slightly unsettled the whole day, well, I found that sometimes my work is better as a result because there might be moments when you're annoyed with them and you work harder or something like that. So I would say that you should be focused on, first of all, getting along. Second, an openness to receive ideas. And third, to question your working ways. When my trainers first started to disagree with me, the first reaction is from your ego. Your first reaction is, that's my idea and you said it's not good. I'm going to sit and defend my idea. But if you can lose that and think, well, why do I have these trainers for at all? And then you think, well, I have let me see if their idea is good or not, and let me argue this based on objectivity.
Hmm.
Then you can learn something. So it's important to have to be able to watch yourself from above, so to speak, have a perspective on whether you're learning something.
Hmm.
But at least in a narrow environment like chess, then it should really be about people you can see yourself spending a couple of weeks with.
Got it. And you alluded to another thing which has profoundly shaped a lot of the world of work and continues to, technology, right? Again, if you look at the disruption of technology in chess, just from a preparation and a scaling up standpoint, from a development standpoint, how has technology fundamentally altered your approach to scaling up as a chess player?
Okay, the first technological, let's say, intervention into chess came in the late 80s when databases started to come.
Mm-hmm.
So already the people who are good in indexing information and you know, who could organize information in a certain way, these were people who knew how to take all the games that were being published, index them, be able to immediately find the
retrieve it and
retrieve the information they're looking for. But this is not just a skill. I mean, even a librarian doesn't only have the skills you think they have. What they have is they know enough about the subject that they're able to look for what they need. And if they don't know the subject matter very well, they'll still be able to find what an expert would find. It's like that. So when computers came along, suddenly the people who was good in chess because of this started to fall back a bit. Because that their skill set wasn't the most relevant here. With a computer, I could just click, type. If I knew how to use the search field well, I could find what I was looking for.
That comparative advantage was taken away.
Yes. Then the second trend which came was the chess playing program started up here.
That is a Deep Blue and the equivalent, is it? Or is it different?
Well, I'm talking the very, very basic versions of this. I mean, also, Deep Blue was on a mainframe. So we'll get to that. These are very weak chess playing programs.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, they would go like four or five moves in every direction.
Mm.
They were thorough, but that's all they could do. So you tended, anything a grandmaster would see into the future would tend to be more accurate than what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very good at, essentially as very basic calculators. You use them to eliminate little errors. Then as slowly they started to get better. So the kind of calculations they could check for you improved a little bit, and then they improved a little bit more. And then this Deep Blue match happened. But Deep Blue was very special because of running very specialized hardware, which couldn't be recreated for anyone. So even though Deep Blue existed and in theory this machine existed somewhere in the world which was stronger than chess players, it didn't affect you right away.
It wasn't accessible to people.
Yeah. Right. Whereas now, if there's a computer somewhere which is stronger than everyone, the chances are they'll let you use it on the internet. That delivery mechanism simply didn't exist back then. So, but right after Deep Blue, I would say within a couple of years, maybe 3-4 years in the max, your laptop became stronger than you. Which means that it'll beat you in any single game that it plays. But you may make a better move here and there over the computer, but it's still, over a game, it would make fewer mistakes than you did and tend to win. Now that against, and what has happened subsequently, because now these programs have just run the course, but it's the same essential process. We've had to withdraw. We've had to concede space to the computers. So they got better in this, then they got better in that, then they got better in that. And first they got better in the things that you thought computers are good at. But then they started to get better in things that we thought we were good at.
Such as?
Long-term calculation, judgment, intuition. So we generally think of intuition as something slightly long-term process. So if I make a move and the reason for that move is 10 moves down the line, that you would tend to associate with intuition. Well, computers got good in that as well. They started making long-term sacrifices, long-term plans, which turned out to be very good because their search depth was increasing and so they were hitting further and further. There's nothing intelligent about these things. But it turns out chess is a game that can be that is perfect for them because very strict rules and an environment where they thrive. And so at first we're conceding space and we're moving along, but eventually it becomes a tool because as computers get stronger and stronger, anybody who consults them can benefit from the information. So what differentiates one chess player from another starts to change a lot.
Correct.
And suddenly if you're not adapting your way of working, you find yourself even players are much weaker than you and neutralizing you.
Hmm.
And because they're using the computer to cover their weaknesses and
so
what
this
do you
is
do?
This is advanced chess or regular chess?
No, regular chess.
Regular chess, okay.
The thing is, if I want to play an opening today against some player and he prepares three lines with the computer and he checks them precisely and then he comes and plays them against you, how are you going to improve on it? Even if you were very good in that area, even if your intuition is very good, if he's worked it out, he's worked it out. So, yeah, and that became a problem. So, over time, you have to learn to use the computer more. So, as the computer becomes stronger and stronger, you change your work methods.
Hmm.
That involves getting rid of your ego because your what worked 5 years ago just no longer works and you have to just get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a working method I'm talking about. And that's more or less where we're driven to today. And nowadays, it's almost extreme. People have adapted themselves completely to, I mean, computers are now so strong, they find in seconds or maybe minutes what it used to take us to a couple of weeks to find. That's the speed of calculation. So what do you do? It no longer makes any sense to specialize in anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because computers, a guy who's never seen that opening will be able to catch up with you in 1 week.
Mm.
And then what's your... So nowadays, most modern chess players are incredibly flexible. They're able to switch in a time. They play everything, what they specialize, what they don't specialize. They move around a lot. And it's becoming about not what you bring to the table, but what can you remember? Can you organize this all this new flood of information in a different way?
Mm.
And what keeps you stronger? And then you shift your skills further and further into the end game and middle game because it's harder for the computer to prepare it all that way.
A couple of things struck me here. First is the piece where Vishy talks about what careers chess players are suitable for and what they possibly aren't suitable for. It was interesting to see him abstract the key themes from the context in a chess playing game. Things such as a fixed set of rules, taking in a lot of data, objectivity required in decision making and so on, and applying that to different canvases to say where these capabilities could be of value. Places like poker, derivatives trading and so on. The reason I mention this is that people often attach too broad a label to themselves, either using an industry or a function, and that often restricts them when they think about what next. It's worth abstracting some of the common underlying themes of the career you're in, and then see where these skill sets and mindsets could be of value. That's an interesting way of thinking about a transition, than just thinking about it at the surface. The other piece that struck me was Vishy mentioning the notion of flexibility in the context of how humans can be relevant in a world where the machines are getting exponentially smarter over time. It's an interesting and a possibly scary time where we need to ensure that we don't get into the super specialization trap where we lose sight of the broader trends and find ourselves irrelevant a few years down the line. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com. You could look for content either by speaker or you could use the search functionality on the site to look for a certain topic you have in mind around leadership, careers, or transitions, and find specific nuggets pertaining to that topic. If you want to listen offline, either during a car ride or, let's say, a plane ride, you could find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or one of the other podcast apps.